rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and we thank you for joining us on this fine Thursday morning. With us in the studio, it's Alan Smith, who's got a very long journey, apparently, on Easter Sunday. They was telling us all about to go and cover Everton.
Yeah, I might not make it home. We'll see.
In which case, enjoy this podcast. It might be the very last time you hear Alan Smith.
It's been nice.
And down the line from Manchester, where there's always news in the world of football, it's Paul Hurst. Later on, we'll be looking ahead to United's trip to Goodison and the battle to stay in the Premier League.
But we start with the Champions League quarterfinal second leg at the Etihad. One of the most incredible matches in the competition's history. 5 goals in the opening 21 minutes, a stoppage time winner ruled out, and at the end of it all, progression to a first ever semi-final for Spurs at the expense of Manchester City. Paul, how do you even begin to sum up what we saw?
Oh, I still don't really know what happened, to be honest. I'm still sort of coming to terms with it. It was an incredible match, definitely the craziest match that I've ever covered. Like you say, 21 minutes in, you've got 5 goals on the board already, and you just wonder how it's going to end up. I actually said to one of my colleagues before the match, you know, this probably will be a crazy game, because it's got all the, you know, perfect ingredients for it. You know, City had to attack because they were 1-0 down, and they've got this, you know, Spurs are obviously very good on offensively as well, and City have just got this mental fragility in the Champions League at this stage of the competition, where they, you know, if they concede, they just seem to concede 2 or 3 in quite, you know, quick succession. They did it against Monaco and Liverpool last season. So it was just an absolutely bonkers match, and it was probably the best attacking performance I've seen from Man City, and they still didn't go through. So, you know, that just sums up how crazy it was.
Well, we have to talk about VAR, of course, which played a huge part in all of the drama last night. Fernando Llorente's goal eventually was confirmed by VAR. Raheem Sterling scoring what he thought was a winner. Alan, do you think VAR got everything right?
Well, in terms of Sterling's disallowed goal, I don't think there's any doubt there.
It's shocking, though, Alan, how many people don't seem to know the rules.
Clarify for us then, Gab.
And I had some confusion about this myself last night. But Bernardo Silva, the fact, you know, people made the point that it was Bernardo Silva playing the ball, that it just deflect off him with Aguero outside. It doesn't matter. It only matters when it's a defending player. When it's an attacking player, it's just simply the last touch. So, you know, Eriksen could have shot the ball at him and it could have bounced off his head and he would have known nothing about it. And if Aguero's offside, he's offside. That's basically what the rules say. And that became a VAR moment because the assistant referee didn't put his flag up immediately. And the reason they don't put their flags up immediately is that if for whatever reason they get it wrong, if there's another touch or whatever, obviously you can't travel back in time and correct that if you stop him before he shoots. So that was actually something where they did everything correctly. And people bringing up VAR, whatever, you know, beyond the emotion of Sterling thinking he'd score, then he realizes he doesn't. A lot of people have a lot of issues with that whole spontaneity celebration thing, but they did everything correctly on that one. I mean, I don't know if you agree, Alan.
Yeah, no, I do. And in terms of the spontaneity thing, I think this argument that, you know, VAR is kind of detracting, you know, drama has been diminished, etc. I kind of felt watching, Hursty might think differently, but watching on TV, I felt like it was intensified even more last night, because you had that sort of, you know, that the TV footage of Pep falling to his knees and then obviously the eruption from the Spurs fans. So, you know, this kind of idea that VAR is kind of taking the emotion out of football is, you know, I find it complete nonsense, because, you know, if that goal had been allowed, we would probably be discussing, you know, wild conspiracy theories, referee, blah, blah, blah. Players and, you know, managers would have come out last night kind of, you know, criticising the referee. Instead, we've had the correct decision. And ultimately, you know, that's for the good of the game.
Well, that is the Raheem Sterling goal then that was disallowed. What about Llorente's goal?
I'm sure Gab, the rules expert here, will be able to clarify. But as far as I was aware, that, you know, next season, because even accidental handballs, goals from accidental handballs will be ruled out, that decision would be different. But in terms of the current rules, it was the correct decision, no?
This whole thing is confusing. So there's some stuff that we don't know. But basically, you're right. So amazingly, as we discovered from Alison, there's an accidental handball. You can score. That is what the laws of the game say. You basically can score a goal with your hands. And we saw it...
Because it's not deliberate.
If it's not deliberate, yeah. Now, that seems like a flaw, or that seemed like a flaw and was surprising to a lot of people. And that's what IFAB has corrected from next season. However, and I asked this directly to, you know, UEFA's head of refs in August, and I said, surely that can't be right. And he's like... This is something, he's like, he was involved in a game once where somebody scored with an, or gained a big advantage with an obviously unintentional handball, and he disallowed the goal. And going by the laws of the game, that's probably not correct, but going by common sense, it obviously is correct. And he said, and I will instruct my referees, you know, to go and disallow those this season. These are directives. So that's what was in play. So the question is, does the referee apply what the directives are, which would be disallow the goal, or does he stick to the letter of the law? That's one element. The other element is, did it actually hit his arm? I think there's different pictures that show this. There's also different pictures. I mean, it certainly looks to me like it brushes against them. To what degree he actually gains an advantage, because that's another thing that's to be considered here, I think is hugely debatable. And then there's a third element here, which is a bit cloak and daggerish. The video assistant referee, who's considered to be the best, most experienced video assistant referee, he didn't need to go and show this to Shakir, unless Shakir actually specifically asked for them. And we don't know if Shakir asked to see it again or not. Certainly his reaction afterwards suggests that it was almost like, oh, why are you showing me this? It's obvious. The goal should stand. So he chooses to show it. However, Shakir only appears to look at two camera angles. He does not appear to look at the angle, which is the one which you may have seen, which BT Sport broadcast, but only later. The one from through the net. So it's the one where it certainly appears the most that it hits his arm. Shakir didn't see that. And that, to me, is odd why Shakir wasn't shown that one. I don't think it's a grand conspiracy, because they could have just not shown Shakir anything if they wanted to and just said, move on, it's fine. That's what's weird to me. And I don't know if there was a mistake there. Others have suggested to me that camera angle is misleading because of distortion and whatever, but that's what we need to wrap our head around. But, I mean, I think we need to be clear on what the rules are. It's got nothing to do with whether his arm was in a natural position or not. It's simply, you know, did it have a material effect and did he gain an advantage, and are they applying the directives, which is sort of a preview of next year's laws, or did he stick to the laws of the game as they stand? So it's complicated now.
It really is very complicated. But as it is Tottenham then that have gone through. Alan, let me ask you, have you ever seen Maurizio Pochettino as emotional as what we saw at the Etihad at the final whistle?
No. I mean, he does on occasion become emotional on the sideline, but I think in comparison to a lot of other managers like Guardiola and Klopp, he's not quite as visibly passionate. And, you know, people have been talking for a very long time now about, you know, yeah, he hasn't won a trophy yet. I mean, that performance last night has to sort of end that sort of tired argument completely, I think. You know, not so much the performance last night, but, you know, progressing past City over two legs. No, it's not a trophy, but, you know, he's proven that he can beat, you know, one of the best teams in Europe. They're in the Champions League semi-finals. There's undeniable progress. And I said a couple of weeks back when we were here that, you know, there was a massive deal for them to reach the top four, because otherwise it would have been a complete disaster in terms of the new stadium next season. But, you know, since then, following a kind of a weird blip, they've kind of stepped it back up again. And, you know, there's no doubt in terms of, you know, Pochettino being a very, very good manager.
But we shouldn't forget as well how injury hit Tottenham are as well. So, I mean, Maurizio Pochettino is working wonders with Tottenham right now, I think it's fair to say. But
well, Llorente was only on the pitch really because they didn't have a midfield backup, because obviously Oliver Skip hasn't played in the Champions League, has played, I think, maybe 3 Premier League games. He couldn't have thrown him into a quarterfinal second leg like that.
But I have to say, that call, that decision to send on Llorente for Sissoko, I thought was remarkable, because it's the kind of call that will be judged solely on the outcome of the game, rightly or wrongly. You can see the logic behind it. You've got Llorente for set pieces. Maybe he can hold the ball up and get fouled. On the flip side, obviously, you're certainly weakening yourself, and Skip is a specialist. And if he'd gone out, I am sure people would have written, oh, well, he doesn't trust the youngsters. What is, this whole myth about bringing young players through, it's all a nonsense. And, why didn't he trust the young lad, Skip? And equally the same issue. If you put Skip on and Skip gives the ball away 50 times and the poor guy's up against De Bruyne and the Silva brothers, then it would have been, oh, well, Skip, clearly wasn't right for it and you should have brought him along sooner and threw him in at the deep end and whatever. It's all just empty words. Unlike ours, of course.
You only have to see on social media the negativity Llorente was getting up until he then scored that all-important goal. It was, it was quite a contrast. Now, Spurs then, through to the semi-final, they're going to face Ajax in the last four. Ajax, of course, the club that everyone are talking about right now, Alan.
Yeah, and I'm still kind of watching them feel a little bit sad, because it's all going to fall apart in the summer when the players are going to move on. And one of the most striking things is that I've kind of read some interesting stuff about Tadic and Blind being Premier League flops, and here they are suddenly in a Champions League semi-final, which again, it goes back to the same point where we make these kind of big judgments. And Tadic, who was initially very good at Southampton, and I think under Koeman he played really well, didn't work out in the kind of latter days, but it's quite evident that he's a very good player. Blind at United, you can look through the players that United have offloaded in the past few seasons, there's kind of a thing, not good enough to make the grade. And I think Hirsty's written in the paper about the United's current squad and how so many of those players aren't really up to scratch. But we make these big judgments that not good enough to play for top four Premier League team, or even in Tadic's case, a mid-table Premier League team, and suddenly they're playing for a team that's beaten two of the biggest teams in Europe in a Champions League semi-final, and it's quite clear that they're not the flops that a lot of people have framed them to be.
They just beat them, they outplayed them too, which is pretty remarkable, just as they'd outplayed Bayern Munich in the group stage. I think that's a really good point. I don't think that Tadic and Blind are necessarily better players than people thought they were.
No, but they're not like flops either, which was the sort of this narrative that had been created when they'd...
I agree. They're not flops. But I think what it shows, though, is the importance of coaching. I think this was the case of Erik ten Hag outwitting and outcoaching Real Madrid and Juventus, because taken as individuals... Obviously, De Jong is a phenomenal player. Van de Beek is a phenomenal player. De Ligt has got a great future. But, go through the rest of the side, and, David Neres is a kid. Ziyech is one of those guys who, if he were in the Premier League, he would be at a mid-table side.
Seems like an Everton signing or something, isn't he?
Yeah, and he'd be criticized for his lack of end product and coming on and dribbling too much or shooting too much or whatever. He's a guy who Premier League clubs have looked at for a long time and has got evident issues. Lasse Schöne is 32 and is what he is. So their wage bill was 1/5 that of Juventus, and I presume 1/8 probably that of Real Madrid. This is down to coaching. This is down to the players. You have some players with tremendous amounts of quality, but what you also have is players who are incredibly intelligent on the day. A manager comes up with the right game plan, sells it to the players, and they go out and play with absolutely no fear. I think you have to give a tremendous amount of credit to them that way. And what this means, Natalie, is that one of the two teams at the Champions League final on June 1st at the Wanda Metropolitano will either be a team that's never been there before or a team that was last there before many of its players were even born.
It's going to be a very fascinating semi-final, that's for sure. But what about Manchester City and the fact that they were on for the quadruple? It's now the treble, as you've alluded to already, Paul. A heartbreaking night for them. Could this affect them in the title race?
Well, it's the fact that they've got Spurs on Saturday again, makes it even more interesting, doesn't it, the run-in. I mean, it's going to be weighing heavily on their minds what happened last night, but you've got to remember they did win the match last night. You know, if a 4-3 win will do them on Saturday again. It's just the kind of deflation of not getting to the semi-finals that will affect them. You know, it's down to my management, it's down to Guardiola now to lift them, and he's got a great track record when it comes to, you know, dealing with players individually. He knows what they want, you know, how they will react to results like this. He's got no choice, really. He's got to pick them up, otherwise they're not going to win the league. I mean, you look at Liverpool now and you'd think that, you know, they are going to win every match that they've got left. So City have to do the same. They have to beat Spurs on Saturday, have to beat United in midweek, next week. You know, there's no choice, really. They've got to win all their games to win the league. So, yeah, they'll have to pick themselves up quickly.
This season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every game in the Premier League. It's just £8 for an 8-week trial. Every Thursday at thetimes.co.uk, our very own Bill Edgar provides 11 trivia teasers for you, and here is one for you on this podcast. Which player has scored 12 Premier League goals this season but is yet to be caught offside? Stick around to the end of the podcast to find out the answer. It was a miserable week for the Manchester clubs in the Champions League as United were dispatched 3-0 by Barcelona, 4-0 on aggregate. Paul, you went out to Barcelona this week, but also to the Barca Youth Academy. Are they on their way back, Barcelona, from what you've seen?
In terms of the first team, obviously it was a complete drubbing of Manchester United. They were, you know, United just fell to pieces. Ashley Young, for some reason, maybe it was a homage to Johan Cruyff, I don't know, but he tried to, as Cruyff turned 20 yards from his own goal and let Messi in, and United kind of folded after that. But in terms of the youth setup, La Masia, I went on a tour around there last week, and it's just an incredible place, a fascinating place, you know, state-of-the-art kind of technology, and really impressive young people, young players, confident players, mature players, and incredibly skillful and talented players. So, you know, they've had a lot of criticism recently about not producing as many stars for the first team as they did for Pep's team, etc. But they've got three or four good young players coming through that they think will make it. And they've recently gone into the first team as well, or first team squad. So they're confident that their conveyor belt still producing the kind of best young players around.
It is, of course, Liverpool that they will face in the semi-finals of the Champions League. Second leg will be at Anfield as well. Barca are the bookies' favourites to win the whole thing, but the tie, Alan, so intriguing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, obviously the winner of the semi-final will go into the final as the big favourites because basically know-how and having been there and done that. I kind of find it quite, you know, Barcelona probably very slight favourites, but I find this tie incredibly difficult to predict. I honestly have no idea who's going to progress because you kind of look at, from watching Barcelona, you know, it's Messi excellence again throughout the entire season, but there are certain players who haven't really been as good as you would sort of expect them to be. I don't think the midfield is as strong as, say, Barcelona midfield was 5, maybe even 6 years ago. Defensively, I feel like, you know, Liverpool can cause them quite a few problems. And, you know, in terms of Liverpool's defence, I feel because they've defended quite well for most of the season that, you know, they could not sort of silence Messi, but keep him a lot quieter than United certainly managed to do. So in terms of the tie, I've honestly no idea who's going to progress.
As for United, then, and that defeat to Barcelona, everyone's spoken about the rebuilding job that needs to be done. And Ole Gunnar Solskjaer said after the game that the squad does need an overhaul. Paul, you've written about this for The Times. Who needs to go?
Oh, quite a few of them. I mean, they are really, you look at that squad and I just think, who are the players who are really top draw, top class silverware winning players? You probably Rashford, Martial, Pogba, De Gea, you know, Shaw, maybe Lingard a push. But you know, the rest is pretty, you know, it's pretty weak, kind of meek existence, really, for a meek group of players. You know, would you hang your hat on Chris Smalling if you were going for the title? Would you do the same with Phil Jones? I just think it does need, you know, 6 or 7 players to leave. It needs a proper revamp and a similar number coming in. But obviously the danger is if they get this wrong again, then, you know, it could be another 4 or 5 years before they're even getting anywhere near challenging for the title. So you look at players like Valencia, he's going to go at the end of the season. Herrera is leaving for PSG. Looks like Mata is heading out as well. Damian, they'll try and sell him. Rojo as well.
The other guy I want to ask you about, because he is a saleable asset and he has a contract issue as well, is David De Gea. Because I guess they've exercised the option on his contract, but they have to extend him now, right?
Yeah, he's out of contract in June 2020.
Right.
And the last time I heard, there were no nearer to coming to an agreement with him about a new deal. He wants basically the same or similar wages to what Sanchez is earning. And this is why the Sanchez deal is been such a terrible deal for United, because everyone else is looking at him in the squad and saying, this guy's earning 350 grand a week, basic, and he's done nothing. I think he scored 3 league goals, and they're all against pretty poor opposition. So,
but this is a curious thing with De Gea. How do you see this playing out? Because what I was told was that United feel pretty confident that they can hardball De Gea for the simple reason that De Gea's reputation, I know here in England you have to automatically say he's the best goalkeeper in the world, but his reputation outside of England is not what it is in England. And secondly, most of the European big clubs already have a top-drawer goalkeeper, with the exception possibly of Juventus, but who knows if they're going to have any money left. So I've been told that United feel pretty confident that, you know, they'll just keep lowballing him and he's not going to run his contract down. But it's kind of a dangerous game to play, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a hugely dangerous game to play, particularly when, I take your point about the big European clubs when it comes to their number ones at the moment. But Real Madrid haven't exactly got an ideal situation when it comes to their goalkeeper. Zidane doesn't seem struck on Courtois, and Navas, you know, he seems to kind of, you know, my personal opinion is he's not that good. I certainly think De Gea is a better goalkeeper than he is. So if Real Madrid see the situation with De Gea not signing a new contract at United, they might put in a £60-70 million bid in for him.
What about a swap with Courtois?
Mm.
That'd be pretty cool. That'd be good for United, right?
If De Gea makes it clear to them he's not going to sign a new contract, then that would be a good deal for him. But the noise from the article last time I heard was that they were absolutely not going to sell him this summer, and they'd rather let him run down his contract. But if it comes to the end of July and they're still in this situation, then, you know, my God, that is an incredibly dangerous game to play. You look at Oblak signing a new contract to Atletico Madrid. I'm not sure what his release clause is, if he's got one. But I imagine it won't be cheap. You know, so who are you going to look to? It's going to cost you an absolute fortune to bring in a new goalkeeper, and you are losing one of the best for free.
Well, it is Everton who are next up for Manchester United. That is on Sunday. In the last month, Marco Silva's men have beaten Chelsea, beaten Arsenal, and then they've also lost to Fulham. So who knows what we're going to get on Sunday, Alan?
Even though they've lost to Craven Cottage, Everton really actually probably in better form than United, aren't they? I'm not too sure how much they really want to finish in seventh and to go into the Europa League next season. But considering the way United have played in recent weeks, and I think really it's, you know, people have kind of said it since Solskjaer got the job permanently, but since the PSG game where, you know, they a remarkable result, but it just hasn't really been the same, has it? Everton, I mean, seen them too much live, I've seen them quite a bit on TV, but every time I watch them I've no idea what to expect. They're just so hit and miss. They could look very good 1 minute and the same game later on look really, really poor and, you know, casual, and, you know, just these random errors which shouldn't happen. So, you know, it's kind of a tricky game to predict, considering I've also noticed it's now more than a month since there's been a draw in the Premier League. I think the last draw was in March 16th, so, you know, depending on Saturday's results, I wouldn't be surprised if it ended up level on Sunday.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
New life was breathed into the battle to avoid relegation on Tuesday night. 18th place Cardiff were 2-0 winners at the Amex, closing the gap on opponents Brighton to 2 points. Now, Alan, you were there. Do Cardiff look more likely to stay up now?
More likely, because the gap has been trimmed by 3 points. I don't think they will stay up, just because it was more down to Brighton being really, really bad than Cardiff being, you know, performing exceptionally. Nathaniel Mendes-Lang scored a really, really good goal for Cardiff's first, and the second was just came from a set piece, and Brighton really just not defending very well. Both have very, very difficult run-ins. Brighton need to go to Wolves, Spurs, Arsenal, and also play at home to City on the final day. And if the title race is still alive, you don't really give them a chance there.
Sorry. But do this. How many points are they getting from these five fixtures?
I wouldn't be surprised if both teams didn't earn another point from those from their remaining games.
Do you think Cardiff are going to lose away to Fulham and at home to Palace?
Well,
Palace.
Yeah,
the only reason I mentioned Palace is that they'll have nothing left to play for. No disrespect to Palace.
Yeah, but I mean, like Fulham recently beaten Everton, where kind of people were like, okay, they're going to have given up. So I don't think Cardiff going there is necessarily
getting 6 points, or maybe not six, but between 4 and 6 points, right?
Yeah, well,
because Man United away in the last day of the season. If United aren't,
then you look at Brighton and you kind of think, you know, Newcastle at home, they could possibly get a result there. Considering Newcastle, you know, really safe now, having beaten Leicester earlier this week, they don't really have much to play for. I just feel like
Arsenal away, if they've fallen off. See, this is what I find fascinating. If Arsenal fall off somehow in the top four race, and Arsenal away, I'm assuming, is going to be around the time of the Europa League final, if they get there. You know, that's what I love. There's all these weird variables going on.
But if Arsenal is still fighting for the top four, you wouldn't really, and considering Arsenal's sort of home form as well, you wouldn't really give them a chance there. I just felt like, you know, Brighton are in this really, really bad place. It's 5 games in all competitions since they've scored. You know, we're kind of saying at the beginning of the season that, you know, they're so reliant on Glenn Murray. And it was fine because he was scoring. And I think he scored something like 9 goals before sort of like early December. And he's got 3 goals since then. He's missed a number of games as well. But Brighton have sort of, you know, had spent relatively a decent amount of money in the summer to try and bring help in for him, and none of those signings have really worked.
You know, you shouldn't ask a question to which you don't know the answer. I don't know the answer, so
let's hear the question.
I'm going to look it up online. But no, you mentioned they were heavily reliant on Glenn Murray. I thought last season they were heavily reliant on Pascal Gross.
Yeah,
what's up with him?
He had spent a bit of time out injured. He actually started his first game in, I'm not sure exactly, but it was quite a while, on Tuesday night. And he looked, you know, he offers them...
Like a guy coming back from injury?
Yeah, at the beginning he looked quite decent, and then faded, just because he's, you know, match fitness quite clearly isn't there. But I think in terms of their midfield, there really isn't much creativity there, and he offers them an extra sort of dimension, which they've really, really badly missed.
So he could keep them up. Like, if they stay up, he's likely to play a big part.
Yeah. Another big thing which struck me was that, you know, they sort of, because they've never been a high-scoring team, they've relied on defending quite well, and they're just now, mostly because they seem sort of, you know, just crippled by anxiety and just really, really low in confidence. There are these sort of basic errors which just shouldn't be allowed to happen. So, like, Cardiff's second goal was, and I know Chris Hughton was like probably more disappointed about the manner in which they conceded the second goal than anything else on Tuesday night, came from a set piece, free kick towards the back post, and Lewis Dunk just completely lost Sean Morrison, who's meant to have been defending. Morrison was allowed to sort of drift behind him. Dunk then mistimed his jump, which are these sort of errors which usually you wouldn't kind of see from, you know, a player who's, you know, has been largely up on them in the past few weeks.
Well, they made them at the weekend too.
Yeah,
it's like two straight defensive.
No, weeks, but yeah. up until like a few weeks ago, right. Say maybe February, Duffy and Dunk have actually been a really good central defensive partnership. And just in recent weeks, I'm assuming it's just that confidence is completely gone. These sort of weird errors have crept in, and it just, you know, it looks quite bleak. And I just think they will survive because I don't see Cardiff, you know, actually getting too many more results despite having to play Fulham.
Pascal Gross was out for just under 2 months, just so you know.
And that's when Brighton kept losing.
You could probably tie it in, yes.
He wasn't as good, I think, this year as he was last year, in pre-injury. But I just thought last year he was such a difference maker and one of the best attacking midfielders in the Premier League. Mm.
As it is then, Brighton lost. You were there, Alan. Do you sense the mood there and the fear that perhaps Brighton fans have and the pressure that is now under Chris Hughton?
Yeah, and I think it's sort of, I looked at the watch, I think there were 6 minutes gone and Dale Stevens had sort of played a really poor pass and had given the ball away. And at the Amex, the press box is kind of, it's behind the dugouts and you're quite close to the fans depending on where you're sitting. So I was sitting right on the edge of the press box and there was a supporter immediately to my right who just rose in fury and started screaming at Hughton for Stevens to be taken off. That anxiety just translates onto the pitch. And it was quite difficult to figure out because there were moments where, you know, the entire ground just seemed to collectively groan if they gave the ball away or if someone mistimed a run. And then, of course, like within 5 minutes of the second half, conceded the second, and, you know, the entire ground just kind of, you could kind of sense the deflation immediately. And there were people leaving after 50 minutes. So I think, you know, it's difficult. If you're a Brighton fan, you're going to be sort of frustrated by how poorly they're playing and the sort of the lack of a sort of plan B, lack of creativity, defensive errors, etc. But at the same time, that sort of pressure, from a player's point of view, I'm assuming, you know, isn't exactly helpful if you're going to be having, you know, fans shouting for you to be taken off after 6 minutes for giving the ball away.
Hi there, and welcome to The Sweeper, which is the Times' fantasy football tip service. I'm Charlie Scott, without Paddy Bear, which is very sad, he's having a week off. So we're into game week 35. It's a pretty juicy looking double game week in fantasy Premier League land. The pick of the bunch, I would say, certainly from a differential perspective, are Watford and Southampton. Watford play Huddersfield and Southampton. A lot of their players, despite picking up plenty of points this season, are not owned by many managers. People like Gerard Deulofeu, who's a bit of a fitness doubt, Abdoulaye Doucouré, Kiko Femenia, the centre-back, and Andre Gray up front, who should be in line to start with Troy Deeney suspended after being sent off against Arsenal last week. There's plenty of value to be had from Watford. Their second match, Southampton, I mentioned. Southampton have also got plenty of players who have very low ownership. Maya Yoshida is one I've picked out, the centre-back. He's started the past six matches and only cost 4.1 million. Their games against Newcastle and Watford. Nathan Redmond is in fine form. He picked up loads of points last time out, and Danny Ings is back, which is always a enticing prospect because he has shown his quality in the past few years. City play Spurs in the first match of the game week on Saturday afternoon, and I think we might see City hit back after being knocked out of the Champions League by Mauricio Pochettino's side. Kevin De Bruyne was particularly brilliant in the second leg of their quarter-final and has been in great form in the Premier League. The only doubt over him during the double game week is whether he'll play both games. They play Spurs on Saturday and then United midweek. Liverpool are an interesting option because they're not playing twice, but they have a great game away to Cardiff. Mohamed Salah looks pretty much back to his best, and they've got a brilliant run to end the season, so I think he's certainly a captaincy option. The best other double game weeks players you should be looking to have in are from Wolves. They've got Brighton and Arsenal. Arsenal themselves play Palace and Wolves, and Spurs as well, who play City on Saturday and then Brighton next week. Eriksen in particular has 26 points in his past three game weeks, so he's worth considering. For more hints and tips, then sign up for the weekly email at thesweeper.co.uk/fantasyfootball, or join our Facebook group by searching for The Sweeper on Facebook, and you can chuck your teams in there, any questions you might have for Paddy or I, and we'll get back to you with some advice.
It is time now for our weekly predictions game, where we pick five matches from this Easter weekend and try to predict the correct score. Just to remind you, Gab, I'm leading 17-12.
It's actually 15-14 with VAR, but anyway.
Unfortunately, VAR does not come into effect until next season.
Exactly.
Let us start then with the rematch, Manchester City against Spurs this weekend.
Yeah, so logic here suggests Manchester City vent their frustration on Spurs and muller them 3 or 4-0. I'm going to go against logic. I'm going to suggest that the trauma and Pochettino's lucky hat suggests that this is going to be very close. I'm going to go 1-0 to City.
Oh, really? Interesting. Well, I am going down the the route of the emotional exertions of the game at the Etihad in midweek in the Champions League will be too much for Tottenham to be able to recreate at the Etihad again. So I think with Manchester City having to concentrate now on the Premier League title race, I'm going for them to win, and to win by 3-1.
All right. Moving on to Goodison, a game that Alan's going to be at. Everton against Manchester United. Jordan Pickford taking on his future team after Neil Warnock takes over from Solskjaer in October and decides that they need more English players.
Wow, Neil Warnock at Manchester United.
Can you imagine?
Wow, that'll be something. I find this one very difficult to call. I'm actually going to go for a draw in this one. I think this is going to end up 1-1.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I just see more goals, so I'm going to say 2-2 between Everton and United.
I did wrestle with 2-2, but okay, fine. To the game then at Cardiff, where it's Liverpool who are the visitors. Liverpool will want to reclaim top spot should Manchester City beat Spurs on the Saturday. I mean, despite the victory over Brighton in midweek, which may have given Cardiff some hope in their relegation fight, I can't really see them getting anything out of this. 3-0, Liverpool win.
Yeah, I'm actually going to go the other way. I could see, you know, like at some point, they're both at incredible pace. And what we do know is that teams that are facing a drop can get nasty and edgy and something can happen. I think Cardiff, let me go out on a limb. Basically, because I need to go out on a limb to win because Charlie stacked everything against me. So I'm going to go for a longer shot and I'm going to say Cardiff 1, Liverpool 1.
Ooh, he's going down the conspiracy theory, Charlie. Let's move into the EFL and League One. Accrington Stanley.
Who are they?
Very good. Hosting Luton. Both of these teams promoted from League Two last season. It's fair to say Luton are the team that are faring the better this time around.
If you say that, I'll need to believe you, and I will assume that Luton are doing rather well.
Should start making stuff up just to steer you.
But, you know, that milk ad was a big formative part of my childhood. So I'm going to say Accrington Stanley 1, Luton 1. Because the other thing that I've learned, and we were both tricked by this after that stupid Sunderland result last week, is not to trust the table in League 1. I think it's entirely made up. I think people just put down numbers and they don't make any sense. Because how could Sunderland, who are supposed to be good, concede 5 goals at home to freaking Coventry, who are about to be wound up? It makes no sense.
Accrington have won only 2 of their last 11 games. They actually did win their last one. So they come into this with a little bit of confidence. They are only 4 points clear of the relegation zone.
So they need the points.
So they do need the points. Luton lost for the first time in League One since mid-October when they lost to Charlton last weekend.
And wheels are coming off.
You could say that, but I still expect them to get back to winning ways. So I'm going for a 2-1 Luton win.
And finally, Paris Saint-Germain against Monaco. Now, you may be wondering, listeners who don't pay a lot of attention, why do they have Paris Saint-Germain in here when surely they wrapped up the league a long time ago?
I know.
They should have, but they didn't, because, of course, last weekend they were beaten 5-1 by Lille. Midweek, they're playing Nantes. They figure, hey, no fuss, no muss, you know, what or not. And they lost 3-1. They still only need a point at this stage to win it. The interesting thing is everybody is injured or suspended. the lineup that he played, you look at the squad from midweek, there's going to be names in there that, well, I don't even think even Thomas Tuchel knew who these people were at the start of the season. And Monaco, I think their results have improved. They will stay up, but so tempted. Wouldn't it be awesome if they screwed this one up and they had to wait another week for the big celebration?
Well, isn't this the fourth time that they're going to try and attempt to win it? Because they drew before those two defeats as well.
Yeah. So I'm going to go for the draw here. And you're going on a limb again. I'm going to say PSG 1, Monaco 1.
Yes. Well, you've made some interesting points there. I just think it's probably now is the time that PSG will be crowned champions. I think it'll be a difficult game. 2-1 win for PSG.
All right, which means they become champions.
Indeed.
Quelle surprise.
Just enough time to give the answer to Bill Edgar's trivia teaser. We asked you which player has scored 12 Premier League goals this season but has yet to be caught offside. And Gab, you were there saying, oh, it's easy. Go on,
well,
then.
Not that many players have scored 12 Premier League goals, but I'm reasonably confident is that he lives on the second floor. And I think I've seen him before. Am I right?
Alan, who is he talking about?
He scores a lot of penalties.
I'm not going to pronounce his name last week in a Bulgarian way.
And
But I don't know if that is how you say it. That's the problem.
Okay, well, do you want to tell us who it is then?
Are we talking about Luka?
Yeah. Luka what?
Milivojevic or Milivojevic? I don't know if that is how you say it, but that's how it just.
Well, right. You were adamant that I was wrong last week.
About what?
Pronunciation of his name.
How would you say
because,
it?
That's because
Milivojevic.
She said it correctly.
Milivojevic?
That's how I
said. But it could be that. Said, yeah. But I just, the way I look at it, I just get Milivojevic. But
you're Bulgarian. You would know.
It doesn't mean anything. Okay, that is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, Paul Hurst and Alan Smith.
And remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and also on your smartphone or tablet. Just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription. For more information, put it in quotes even. That's what I like to do when I go and use DuckDuckGo for my searches. And sometimes Bing, too.
We'll be back on Monday ahead of a midweek Manchester derby.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.